Hey, everybody. Podcast editor Christy here. A lot of you know that the Western Colorado Writers Forum has monthly writers' nights on the first Tuesday of every month. In December, we're going to be having a writers' night fundraiser. We'll have a few presentations on writing with a silent auction between presentations. We'll also be doing a writer's trivia game emceed by Jim Van Pelt. The biggest and coolest thing that night, of course, is the silent auction. You can bid on a lot of great local goodies from places like Enstrom's and Main Street Bagels. We'll also have services such as a full copy edit of a manuscript by author and podcast host Avery Brooks, a personal social media coaching session with our forum board president, Melody Jones, and so much more. We'll also have snacks, and it's free, so bring your friends. It will be December 6th, that's a Tuesday, at 6 o'clock p.m. at the Grand Junction Art Center. Doors open at 5:45. Second thing, a note about this episode before we get into it. This was the first official interview that Avery and I recorded for this podcast. We sat down with Dr. Laura Tohe last November, so this interview is a full year old. And it's full of amazing stuff, but we were still learning our audio equipment. So there is a possibility you might notice some small sound differences in this episode compared to our other episodes. Either way, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Western Colorado Writers Podcast, where we talk to writers about writing. I'm Christy Mathern.
And I'm Avery Brooks.
And we're your co-hosts. Today, we're here with Dr. Laura Tohe.
Dr. Laura Tohe is Poet Laureate of the Navajo Nation and Professor Emerita of English at Arizona State University. And Dr. Tohe, would you like to introduce yourself in your native language?
Yes. Shalora Tohe Dashachin, Tsinahabilina Shlatoraji in Bashachin, Johanna Etoatlana Dashache Doma e Deshkijini Dashanala, Akoto e Estanchle. So my clans, which we introduce ourselves through, is that I am Sleepy Rock People Clan, born for the Bitterwater Clan, and my maternal grandfather clan are the Sun Clan people from Laguna Pueblo, and my paternal grandfather clan are the Coyote Pass people.
Thank you. And we really appreciate you coming and speaking with us after your writer's night with the Western Colorado Writers Forum. So can you tell us a little bit about why you are here in Grand Junction?
I'm here as part of two events that are going on. One was the writers' conference, and the other was I was asked to be the keynote speaker for the Upper Colorado Mesa Conference. And so I've been doing a number of things, and the other thing I'm going to do is give a talk on the Navajo Code Talkers to some schools tomorrow. So I'm here for 2 days and doing speaking and poetry readings.
Wonderful. So when did you first find poetry as a creative outlet?
In college. I grew up in this little village in Crystal, New Mexico, on the Navajo Nation homeland. And I was never introduced to poetry until probably junior high or high school. I didn't know what poetry was, but I knew it at that young age I wanted to be a writer because I read. That was how my brothers and I entertained ourselves in this little village of Crystal. There was probably maybe 300 or so people there. There's also a boarding school there. But fortunately, my mother knew that I liked and enjoyed reading, so she would take me to the Gallup Public Library, and I got to check out all kinds of books. Most of them were fairy tales. I read a lot of Russian fairy tales and didn't know that. I also read comic books and read books on, well, actually, where my brother had comic books, and they had Superman, Spider-Man, and Supergirl and all that, and I read their comic books. That was way back, so Superman didn't happen just 20 or 30 years ago. It happened longer than that, so I was reading some of the early Spider-Man and Superman books. But I also liked Nancy Drew. I had a series of her books, and I liked Little Madeline, Little Lotta, which was a comic book. So all those things were part of my enjoying and wanting to become a writer. Unfortunately, I didn't read any texts or poems written by a native writer until I was in college. And in high school, we did read some poetry in English class. And that really intrigued me, you know, because I think I was reading Pilgrim's Progress or the teacher was telling us about these stories, and I just was fascinated by them, and I wanted to be a writer. But like I said, because I wasn't exposed to any Native writers, I didn't read any of their work until college. And inside, I had this longing, this yearning to be a writer, but I didn't know how one did that. All the books I had ever read were written by non-Native peoples. So somehow I got it in my head that Native peoples don't write, you know. So when I did decide to take creative writing classes, eventually I realized I had to blaze my own trail. And so I did that when I was in graduate school. So that was my story of becoming a writer. And I've been doing other things besides writing poetry and fiction essays. I've also been writing some librettos for oratorios, which is kind of like a opera, but not quite as full-blown, but it still requires, you know, having to write the words for a work of performance.
I listened to a little bit of it. It's beautiful, by the way, or one of them at least.
Oh, thank you.
What does your process for writing poetry look like? How do you get into your creative zone?
Well, I think it's been changing over the years that I've been writing. I've been writing about 40 years. Recently, what I've been doing is looking back at some of my old journals. And one of the lines that came from my journal was this line that said, "My body holds stones." And that thought, that sounds like an interesting title. And I thought, I'm going to work with that. And so that was my opening. So I did write a poem on that. And it was actually translated into music by a composer, Brett Weary, last summer. He translated my work and three other poets' work. The theme was stones, and so my poem was selected for that. But yeah, it varies. When I wrote librettos, what gets me started is just collaborating, first of all, with the composer. We talk about what do we want to have this say, you know, what's the theme we're working with, you know, and then we just kind of brainstorm ideas. And from that, I don't know, it just comes to me. And I'm always amazed what comes to me. You know, because sometimes I think, how am I going to write this? Especially when it comes to librettos, because it's a long piece you have to think about, because people are going to be singing these words. And it involves thinking mentally that I have to write something that's going to be performed for at least an hour. So actually, when I first get this idea, then I can work with it, then I can go with it when I write a libretto. Poetry comes to me in different ways. I was in the Northwest. I went to a Japanese garden, I believe it was in Oregon. And I was looking at this sculpture, and it just looked like a story about someone who was leading animals away from something. And that became the subject then of a poem, is just from the sculpture that I saw. And it seems like lately I've been writing about global warming, especially with this last libretto that I wrote called Nahastan in the Glittering World, and that poem about seeing these animals leaving. I'd also been going back, I think, to the Indian school where I lived. So there's a lot of things I think that I can draw on as a writer, you know, from things that I see. Maybe somebody says something to me that sounds very interesting. And just emotion sometimes, you know. So it comes from all different ways.
So how has writing helped you process your own life experiences and express your ideas? And our next question, I'll kind of add Christy's in here, was actually about your poem last night, "My Body Holds Stones." And if you don't mind, because I think it's related, talking about the significance of journaling to help mm-hmm. express those life experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, this poem called "My Body Holds Stones." Like I said, I found that in my journal, and then I started to think about what is this poem about, you know. And I don't often know what a poem is about or what a line or an image is about until I start writing about it. And what was coming out was this idea of stones and how, you know, sometimes we might have experienced something traumatic, something that is not a positive thing, and how we can internalize that trauma. And when I was writing this poem, I started writing about, most of it was about the boarding school and when I went there and what I saw. And the speaker in that poem then writes about these memories of what the boarding school was about. Because we haven't, as Native peoples, we haven't healed from the boarding school experience yet. And just this past summer, that's when the bodies of these young children were found in a mass grave at a boarding school. So that's still coming out. This poem then, I think, speaks to that internalized trauma and injury to Native peoples all over this country, including Canada, and even in other places where children were expected to assimilate into the dominant culture, places like Australia. So those are, I think, the experiences that we are just starting in some ways to write about. The Jewish people have written and spoken and are still speaking about the Holocaust, you know. So we as Native peoples, we're just trying to speak about that and work towards some sense of healing, some way of healing for that. But when we're confronted with these new stories about mass graves and boarding schools, you know, it makes it, that wound is still there. And so that poem was speaking about that. And I actually wrote that poem before the bodies were discovered. So yeah, it's something that I think we have to speak of it, because a lot of times, sometimes traumatic events, people don't want to talk about it. Oh, that happened, you know, and that's it. But I think that some of those traumatic experiences have to come to the surface, and we have to deal with them in order to move ahead and go forward.
And in your talk last night, you know, about writing towards healing and transformation, you mentioned trauma from colonialism, assimilation, and kind of forced loss of your Native identity. And so I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about how you've used your writing and poetry to preserve cultural traditions, address oppression, and really reclaim your identity.
One way I do that is to use Navajo language when I write poetry. I went to a boarding school, as I said, where we were not allowed to speak. You know, we were punished for speaking Native language. And this is in the late 50s and early 60s when I went to this boarding school on the at Crystal. And one way, I think, to reclaim language, reclaim our stories, reclaim this way of thinking is through the language. So I write poetry in Navajo, because that is an act of reclaiming. And sometimes I translate, you know, I do bilingual poems because I know I have an audience that doesn't speak Navajo. So I'm aware of that too. So, you know, I have works out there that are in English. The claiming of our identity, though, it also takes place personally for me by participating in ceremonial life of the Navajo people. And I've gone to blessing ceremonies, and I've gone to some healing ceremonies. Those are ways, I think, of being grounded in this identity that I was given. And I like to say that, you know, the language that I was given, I was dressed in this language, the Navajo language. That's my identity. That's my clothing. And I have to remember that that's important, you know, that we didn't forget that, we didn't leave it behind, that we are still here, we are still surviving, and we want to continue on as the way our ancestors taught us personally. You know, that's, I think about that. And so that's a way of reclaiming, also reclaiming the stories, you know, reclaiming our stories, our language, our identity. And I think this is happening all over Native country. We are starting to indigenize lots of things, you know, our research, our clothing, popular culture, you know, and a lot of things are happening in that there's this amalgamation of Native culture and non-Native culture. And a good example of that is skateboards. I went to this event in Globe, Arizona recently, and there were these young guys that had these skateboards, and they had paintings of Apache people painted, and they were doing these skateboard events, you know, clothing, you know, we're part of culture, popular culture, music, you know, everything is, it seems like, is being indigenized. That was, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't see that. You know, we didn't see murals of Native peoples. We didn't see people wearing hats that had, you know, beading on it. You know, that was all, you know, we just didn't do that. But now I see a lot of that happening. And it's great to see that, you know, we don't have to leave ourselves behind. You know, we can bring ourselves and we can go, we can make changes like that, make a way for ourselves, blaze our own trail.
In writing, and especially in poetry, linguistic choice is key. And as the daughter of a code talker, can you talk just a little bit about the relationship between the Navajo language and the code spoken by the code talkers?
You know, I didn't know that my father was a code talker until 1984. That's surprising, but when I did this oral history research with some of the last remaining code talkers, I did interviews with 20 and some of their descendants. And all of the descendants that I spoke with all told me they didn't know that their father, their grandfather had been a code talker. And I found out that the reason is in case the code needed to be used again, it would be available. So they were discharged and told never to reveal that the code had been used and what the code was. And so I didn't know until 1984 my father had been a code talker. I knew there had been code talkers because I'd see them in public. They'd be dressed in their uniform and they were in parades, or they would talk about, you know, they would be at events, but I didn't know my father had been one. And my father, I think, didn't like to talk about the war. He was like many soldiers who go to war, they're come back with symptoms of PTSD. And my father was very upset when my two brothers were playing army, that's what they used to call it. And my father scolded them and said, you know, war is nothing to play at. So he made them stop. But the language, we know that this language was used as a weapon. It was a secret weapon that was used. It was developed into a code that only they knew. Only the code talkers knew that. And they came up with this code within a relatively short period of time, like within a few months, maybe not even that. And then they were sent out to the South Pacific. And they used this code to deliver messages that saved many American lives. It was quick and it was accurate. And ironically, back home in these boarding schools and these parochial schools, they were being told, no, don't speak your language. You know, they were being punished for it. And then when they got into the service, they were told, now you're going to use your language to develop a code. And they were flabbergasted. They said, what? Back home, we were told not to speak Navajo. And now you're saying we're going to develop a code, you know? So that was some very interesting stories that I heard from 20 of these code talkers that I interviewed. And I'm very proud that my father was one of the code talkers and the language helped save America, you know, because this is a language that was used only during that time. And there were other tribal nations that used their language also during World War I and World War II. But I think the Navajo code talkers are probably the ones that are most known for that.
Have you ever used the code syntax at all in a piece of poetry?
No, I haven't, but I've thought about it. You know, I thought, could I use these words in a poem? You know, and they had to make up words that we don't have in our language. Like, for example, grenade, you know, or torpedoes, tanks, you know. We didn't have those words in our language. And so they, what they did is very, very astute in how what they did was they said, okay, we'll use the word tank. We'll use turtle. And so they said, you know, this tank acts like a turtle because it moves very slow on the ground. You know, it moves along very slow. And so the word for tank became turtle, jetarahi. And the language is also very visual. So when you say turtle, jetarahi, what you can visualize is something that moves very, very slow, like a turtle. Or there were words for artillery that came from, well, a lot of them were animals, like, you know, hummingbird. And grenade was potato, because a potato you can hold in your hand and you can throw it. And that was, I think, the most interesting one. But I can say I do use what the code talkers use, because the language, the Navajo language, is very visual. It's very verb-driven. It's a very active kind of language, and that's what the code talkers did when they developed these code words. They looked at these animals and what they did and made a word for them.
Can you talk a little bit about the different mediums? I know you've mentioned the librettos that you've written, that you've used for your work, and do you feel that some are better suited for expressing ideas than others? I know you talked about the power of speaking poetry and things like that.
Yeah, I think so. Like, for example, if you use poetry oftentimes in my work is shorter. You know, maybe it's, sometimes it could be longer, maybe 4 or 5 pages when I'm doing a very long prose poem. Like this one poem I wrote, it's called The Windmill. That poem is about, it's a prose poem about 4 pages long. It has a lot of description in there about the land and animals. And I find that using poetry and using those words seems so much more appropriate for what I want to say in a poem. If I were writing an essay, I think it's a little bit more formal-like, more linear-like. And so when I'm using that medium, I'm thinking like that. I'm thinking this has to be, the sentence has to come after this one after that. Then I have to introduce my next paragraph, you know, and all, you know, these forms that I learned in school. But poetry, if I'm writing a poem, I can oftentimes just do what I want to do, how I want to create this poem. And that includes how it looks on the page. And because poetry, it can also be like a written art, or, you know, like a painting, because if you use words, you can decide how you want it to look on a page. And because I come from a family of weavers, on both sides of my family, grandmothers and mother, aunts were weavers. I think that you can do that with paper. You can weave words on paper. This poem that I wrote that I mentioned earlier, My Body Holds Stones, it's all left justified. So there's a lot of white space on the right side. When I first started, I sometimes do these things unconsciously. I just started writing really short lines on the left side. And then I looked at it again. I thought, what am I doing here? Maybe this isn't how the poem should be written. So then I made the lines longer and wrote, I think, one stanza. And I thought, no, it looks better the other way, because that's what I'm working with. There's all this space that was, there's this potential and the space that's not used, and space of trauma and space of negativity. It's all on the right side. On the left side, what happened in these boarding schools, I was being squeezed, you know, my language was being squeezed out of me. My identity was being squeezed out of me. So you'll see on the left side, it's all just these words. So, you know, with poetry, it's possible to do that and think of a page as how you're going to design your words. For librettos, when I wrote my first libretto, I asked the composer, how should I write this? And all he said was, write lines this long. And he held up his finger, and that's what, about 3 inches or 4 inches long. That's what he said, write lines that long. And I thought, oh boy. You know, when he first asked me to work on this project with him, and he was telling me all about it, and he said, would you write the libretto for this oratorio? And he, you know, went on, he talked about it, and it sounded very interesting. I'd never written one. I didn't even know what a libretto or an oratorio was. Even after we hung up, and I've had to look it up in the dictionary, and I had already said I would do it. So, oh, wow, what did I get myself into? And now I have to write really short lines, which is, you know, I could do that. That wasn't that difficult. And so what I relied on was poetry to write this libretto. So, yeah, poetry, I think you need, at least for me, I needed my poetry for a libretto. Yeah, and I've written some fiction a little bit. And I've written some creative nonfiction as well, too. So I think that as a writer, I have a sense now of what something needs. You know, is this a poem? Or is this a longer piece? Or is this a piece of creative nonfiction? You know, and I've been writing long enough to know. And I guess a lot of it is you have to rely on your own sense. You have to trust yourself. you know, this is a poem about this, you know, and you have to listen to your gut. And so one of the things I always do is read my work aloud. And when you do that, you start to become aware how words work together with the rhythm of a language, the rhythm of a line, even the way a word sounds for me. So writing to me is already a lot like writing music, because music relies on rhythm, also relies on how a word sound or how words are put together. So it's always, to me, it's always been about music, and writing poetry is like writing music. I don't know how to, I wouldn't know how to compose anything, but I can do it through words, I think.
What do you most want people to take from your work, and are you working on anything right now you'd like to share?
I think now what I've been working on, this libretto that I wrote, Nastan in the Glittering World, what I was concerned with and the theme that I wanted to work with, and again, my collaborator, Thierry Picou, who's a French composer, we talked about this idea of, first of all, healing. He wanted to include that in our work, and I was happy with that theme. Again, you know, we had this long discussion of what do we want to do, and I was reading about what's happening with global warming, experiencing it myself, living in the Southwest, the drought, and, you know, seeing places being hit by tornadoes and all the destruction that's going on in the world, including, you know, animals and what's happening to the animals, to the forests, you know. All of this, you know, has been in my mind. And so we talked about that. And so I started writing about that. And I think that's really a big part of what I wanted to write about, was this is what's going on. We need to pay attention to this. You know, we don't have any place to go, you know, and humans have taken so much, taken and taken and taken, and what have we given back, you know, and we're in trouble now. And so that's really, to me, it's very important, because as I mentioned, growing up with a people who really believe in this interconnection with the earth and taking care of the earth, being good stewards of the earth, all of what's happening now is just an indication that humans have not been good stewards of the earth. We have not taken care of the earth. We've constantly taken, we've manipulated the earth, and we've polluted the earth in so many ways. And to me, that's really important. That is what I've been writing about. And also water, being a bitter water person from my father's side, that also concerns me, is what's happening to our water, or even the lack of the water, or even too much water. So yeah, I've been writing some poems about water, and I hope that I will continue to work on these, and that it will lead me to a manuscript on water. And I want to go to some of these places that have, you know, some significance for us. There's a place in New Mexico where it said the Navajo people emerged, and it's a water place. There's other places where water was polluted. I want to go to some of those places and write about that.
So, Dr. Tohei, it was an honor to speak with you. We really appreciate your time and willingness, and especially your patience. What you're saying is just so important, you know. Thank you. And for listeners to find more information about Dr. Tohei and her works, many are very incredible, as well as the librettos to listen to, you can go to lauratohei.com. Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and for listening to what I have to say. Ahyehe.
The Western Colorado Writers Podcast is the official podcast of the Western Colorado Writers Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Grand Junction, Colorado. The Forum's mission is to foster a rich and diverse writing community on Colorado's western slope that invites participation from diverse cultures, customs, and life experiences. The Forum hosts Writers' Night presentations at the Grand Junction Center for the Arts on the first Tuesday of every month, where local and national writers give presentations on their craft. Sign up for the Forum's free newsletter at westerncoloradowriters.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Western Colorado Writers Podcast. If you have thoughts or suggestions for the podcast, please drop us a line at westerncoloradowriterspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is made possible through the support of the Grand Junction Commission on Arts and Culture.